Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. In case you've forgotten, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and here with me as always, my co-host, Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hey.
Nick Newman couldn't be here, couldn't get out to see the movie, and also just had a whole bunch of plans for the weekend. So in order to take his place, we got the only man who could ever conceivably take his place, and that is our esteemed editor-in-chief and benefactor, Jordan Raup.
Hello, glad to be back.
It's always great to have you.
Thanks.
Because as long as we put you on every now and then, your incentive to cancel us will be minimal.
Exactly.
It's going to be an interesting episode today. We'll be having a new review, our primary review, that will be A Walk Among the Tombstones, the newest film starring Liam Neeson, written for the screen and directed by Scott Frank, who did The Lookout, which is a movie I quite enjoyed from a while back. Before we get into that, we will be talking about random things that we've watched in the hiatus that the show has taken while I was at Toronto. If you didn't get a chance to listen to the Toronto dispatches I did, make sure to go back and check that out, because I definitely talk about a lot of movies during that. And I'll also give you an interesting view at what it's like to go to the Toronto International Film Festival. Other than that, as always, feel free to send us an email, podcast@thefilmstage.com, with any thoughts or ideas or suggestions you have. Also, make sure to leave us comments and ratings on iTunes, and follow us on Twitter, @FilmStageShow. And, that's about that. Also, P.S., make sure to stay tuned all the way to the end of the episode when we can tell you how to win a Blu-ray of the film Ida, pronounced Ida for anyone who actually cares. We talked about it on the show a while back. We all quite enjoyed it, and you can find out how to win a Blu-ray by listening to this show. But that's that. For being gone for so long, not a lot to catch you up on that front. However, we have all had a chance to watch quite a few films, so we're going to jump on into that. The first will be from Jordan. So Jordan, what is something that you watched while we were all off doing our own thing, and what'd you think of it?
Sure, yeah. I watched a film called God Help the Girl, which actually was on my list to see at Sundance, but couldn't get around to it, and, our good friend Rafi reviewed it instead, and he didn't quite like it, so I kind of put it off my radar because I trust the man. even though we
trust the man,
yes, even though we liked the Raid 2, I still trusted him. But anyways, but I did like this movie a lot. I caught up on it. It's on VOD, and it's actually getting quite a decent. I mean, not crazy release, but it's in like 50 to 100 theaters, which is pretty good for a film like this, which has a really tiny distributor. But anyways, yeah, it's the directorial debut of Stuart Murdoch, who is the frontman of Belle and Sebastian, which is an indie band that was more popular, I would say, maybe like 10 years ago or so.
Yeah,
and if you like their tunes, you really like this this movie. It is a musical, so at first I forgot that when I watched it, and she starts breaking out in song. And anyways, the star is Emily Browning, who is familiar in this territory because she has like kind of mental issues and an eating disorder. And so if you've seen Sucker Punch, or she's in another movie also that has kind of similar premise, but this is much better than Sucker Punch.
Well, thank God for that.
Yeah, and she's great in it, and it definitely has some of the criticism that I've read is it's like a little too twee and just kind of you know, if you even look, like, there's people that have been turned off by just like one still from the movie, just like there's kids, kind of quirky kids dressed up and like in like a wheat field, and so I can see that also kind of turned me off a little bit. But
yeah, I'm pretty through with watching people wander through fields of wheat. I won't
exactly
fucking lie. That's kind of old.
It actually has more of like it did kind of remind me a little bit of Moonrise Kingdom, but not as like, you know, the directorial style isn't as controlled. But it has kind of that quality. And it's also, I don't know if you guys saw We Are the Best, but which came out a little bit ago, but it has a really good, it would be a really good double feature because they're both movies about kind of these kids that get together and try to start a band, and they obviously don't become you know, like U2 or anything. It's just like kind of about like their summer in this small, like, few months where they kind of got together and tried to make music, and just it has a really strong spirit and really good music. And yeah, I would recommend it. Definitely. It's a good watch.
All right. Danny King, what's something that you've checked out?
Well, first one I can talk about is The Drop, which I was looking forward to a lot, kind of for similar reasons to A Walk Among the Tombstones. They're both kind of like September crime releases with no awards pretensions or anything like that, just sort of good like pulp drama. And they both have novelistic credentials. This one was written by Dennis Lehane, adapted from one of his short stories. I ended up being mixed on the film, kind of. I think, especially for something that was written by Lehane, a lot of the characterizations and kind of the work of setting feel a little bit broad. Like Matthias Schoenaerts plays this guy who is kind of crazy, and there's a scene he has with Tom Hardy where he kind of comes over and threatens him with an umbrella, and there's just this weird like forced kind of playing with the umbrella, and then he leaves and it's supposed to be threatening, and it's kind of like one of many examples in the film where it seems like just much broader than some of Lehane's previous work. The one interesting thing about the movie, the weirdest thing about it, is Tom Hardy's performance. The film is definitely aware of this character, and the whole movie kind of builds on not so much a plot, but almost like a character twist, and it plays with that. But even with that knowledge, Hardy seems to be in kind of a different world than the movie. There are just a lot of really awkward reaction shots where he seems to be pausing more than the other actors, or the camera will just kind of linger on him, and the character is so anti-social that his hesitations are almost comical, which doesn't necessarily fit in with the rest of the movie, but it's at least weirder than a lot of the other stuff we get, kind of like standard, like, mobster types. And there's a weird continuity error moment where, like, in one scene, Tom Hardy corrects James Gandolfini on like an ethnic term, and then in the next scene James Gandolfini could correct someone else on a different ethnic term. So it's like, I'm not sure what the scale is supposed to be. Like, the initial impression is that James Gandolfini is someone that's like not too intelligent about these things, but then suddenly he's correcting someone else. So it just like,
maybe Tom Hardy really got through to him.
Maybe he did. Maybe he changed him. Left a very strong impression. Which is sort of odd, unconvincing, things like that. And the ending is kind of surprising, but even the way it deals with that, it's sort of like patting itself on the back for its own cleverness. I know, Jordan, you're also kind of mixed on it.
Yeah. I wrote a full review that you could read on the site. And I was definitely mixed as well. I agree with you. There's an interesting thing that happens in the end to a certain character. Kind of like a reveal that you kind of half expect coming, and if the movie carried through with that, I think it would have actually, if you went out of the movie thinking, wow, this was kind of building to something and it made it interesting. But I really disliked kind of the very last scene. It kind of becomes more of like a crowd pleasing ending. I'd relate it to The Town, actually, if you guys know the ending of that movie. And so it's just kind of disappointing on that level. This was a movie I was super excited for, just having like Bullhead, the last movie from Schoenaerts and Roskam. And the cast is incredible, but it's just everything feels kind of surface level. There's what I liked about Bullhead most is like the guy was kind of a jerk, but you really got like under his skin, and just the way it was directed was really enveloping and really intense. And just everything here kind of seemed a little like half-assed, which was unfortunate.
Okay. Well, I got to see, aside from everything I saw at Toronto, the film The One I Love, which has Elizabeth Moss and Mark Duplass. It's a good film. I'm not going to tell you anything about the plot, because I didn't know anything about the plot going into it, other than it's a couple that's like having some marital difficulties, and they go on a retreat to try to like bring the spark back into their relationship. That's really all you need to know. It goes to a lot of interesting places. It's actually a really fun, really entertaining movie. The ending is kind of creates this weird forced ambiguity that maybe undercuts a little bit of the more fun stuff that's going on before that. But it's a very good, very intelligent, very naturalistically made and written film where the characters don't do really stupid things and everyone acts like a human being, which is sadly all that I ask of most of my movies. And it's on, I think it's out in limited release, and it's on like basically every VOD platform. And yeah. It's really fantastic. It's really good.
So yeah, I liked it. I agree, Brian. Good job.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm also able to sum it up in like a quarter of the time that you all take.
Wow.
That's another reason why you're better than us.
Exactly.
One of many.
One of the many. I guess, do we have other ones, right?
Jordan, yeah, I have two.
I have two more.
Real quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll do one really quick. Eleanor Rigby, the full title is The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, Them. Really, really catchy title. this movie kind of got butchered by the Weinstein Company, I would say. If you've heard of it at all, it you probably have heard of the cool kind of approach it takes, which is a love story from two different perspectives. Well, it's actually an anti-love story, I would say, from two different perspectives. But Weinstein Company convinced the director to cut it into two movies, and the one that will get the widest release, and it didn't even do that well, so it's probably not coming to the theater near you, was released, I think, last week. And it's Jessica Chastain and James McAvoy. And I don't want to say too much about it because it is tries to play up a mystery aspect, at least in this version I saw. You can definitely tell there's something more interesting happening. Hopefully, I have not seen the Her and Him versions. I would seek it out just because Jessica Chastain, like always, is good in everything she's in. And so I would recommend on that level alone. And some of the ideas it plays with are kind of interesting. But it just feels like a project that maybe under a more capable director could have been kind of this epic movie that we would see the correct version of right away. So maybe hear for our thoughts when that version comes out so we can see it, so we can talk about that. But yeah, so that's all there is for that. And I think that's not on VOD or anything. That's only a limited release. And it's dwindling. So catch it if you want to see it.
The other film.
Yeah, the other film, I only had to bring it up because you talked about this during your TIFF dispatch with John Fink. And I love John Fink, but Kevin Smith's Tusk is a film that came out and did fairly horrible this weekend at the box office.
Oh, did it actually come out?
Yeah, it came out this weekend. Oh, I think it was in like 1,000 screens, and it didn't even get even anywhere. I don't think it even got close to the top 10.
Good.
So this will be forgotten very quickly. Yeah, it didn't. Yeah, it made $886,000, which is pretty weak for...
Even worse than Cop Out.
Yeah. Well, this was only 600 screens, I guess. So
oh, okay.
Cop Out was. But yeah, this movie is a touch better than Cop Out. So there we go.
Put that shit on the poster.
Yeah, exactly. John already kind of probably laid it out if you listen to it. And you probably don't know the premise if you're online, because Kevin, you can't kind of go anywhere online without reading Kevin Smith's latest rant or whatever. He likes to do. But I kind of hated this movie. It feels like what could have been a fun idea in like a 5 to 10 minute short stretched out. Michael Parks is absolutely great, as he was in Red State. But he's only, you know, he's only given maybe 15 minutes to really shine. And the rest, there's a character that pops up, which you know by now, so I'll just spoil it. But Johnny Depp is in the movie for much more than just a glorified cameo. He's kind of the last act of the movie. And as soon as he pops up, the film just kind of goes to a grinding halt. And he has one scene that as I was watching it, I was like, how did someone direct this? And then as they were editing it, thought it would be, good that other humans saw it. And but anyways, it made it in the movie. It's like you'll know if you see it. It's a flashback scene within a flashback, and every line, like every delivery in that scene, every line, like it's just you're wondering what is going on. So anyways, Justin Long is kind of amusing towards the later half of the film when he becomes what you think he will become. And I'll just say that. But anything else, yeah, none of the jokes were for me. Just overall, it's not very funny, not very scary. So yeah, just wait for the gif of when you see Justin Long as a walrus. And that's about the 3 seconds that are kind of worth it.
Jesus Christ.
For this movie. So yeah, I can't really say anything too promising, but I'll give John Fink the benefit of the doubt, because I will agree with some of his review where if I was in the Midnight Experience, and I was like half dozing off, it would have been some sort of fun nightmare, I guess, with Kevin Smith and not there and riling you up as he does. But yeah, if you're watching this, like, on a Saturday afternoon, I can't just imagine what yeah, just avoid it, just don't do it. Walrus, no.
All right. And Danny, did you have another film that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, just a few brief observations about The November Man, which was really awful.
Which was you said something, it was like it's vintage Brosnan, remember? That was like on a trailer somewhere.
I think it was in a tweet.
Oh god.
Yeah. All right. And because I mean, I grew up, you know, watching his Bond movies, so I do kind of have like a nostalgia for him in this kind of role. But the movie, I mean, one of the worst things about it is that it's just insanely violent. So every gunshot wound has a really grotesque amount of like blood splatter. And the movie opens with a stakeout. And Pierce Brosnan is being chased through this crowded square, and the guy who's covering him shoots at the perpetrator, but accidentally shoots a kid and kills a kid. And then it like cuts to the title card, and it's like, it's almost as if they're like, yeah, this is the tone we want to set. Like, kids are going to die in this movie. Jesus. And it's going to be brutal. And it's like the most off-putting opening. But then there are other parts in the movie where, like, the incompetence is actually sort of amusing. Like, there's one scene where we're watching a surveillance camera, and then on, like, the left side of the screen, and then in the upper right-hand side of the screen is Will Patton, who's, like, Skyping in. So, like, we're looking at the surveillance camera, and he's on Skype. And so he obviously can't see the surveillance camera, but he's still in the frame. So, like, we're just sort of looking at him, like, staring into space for, like, a few seconds, a few different times. And it's like he clearly has no idea what he's supposed to be doing, because he can't interact with what the content of the scene is. So that was, like, really awkward. And then the other thing that's funny is, like, you know, at some point the movie will have to explain like what the November Man means or where that nickname comes from. And so they save it for like the climax of the movie. And it's like the stupidest line. I'm reading this from IMDb. And the guy says, "Know what we used to call you, Peter? The November Man. 'Cause after you passed through, nothing lived. You were one bleak motherfucker, my friend."
What are you talking about? This sounds amazing.
And then, well, it's hilarious. And then it, like, it cuts to Brosnan, and he's just like, yeah, I was. Like, I remember those days. And it's just
isn't,
so
isn't
stupid.
Like, December and January considered worst months of the year?
Yeah.
Like, so before winter?
I guess, yeah. That's what they're saying. After he passes through, nothing lives. So it's like, that's the beginning.
Like, the start, I see.
I thought it was like, you know how, like, when you see an old guy and a young woman, or an old woman and a young guy, like, dating... Or I guess it doesn't have to be gendered, but fuck it. When you see an old person and a young person dating, you're like, oh, it's a May-December romance.
Oh, well, that would work for this, because isn't Olga Kurylenko the love interest?
Right.
Yeah,
so
there's
it's like, someone would be like, oh, May-December, and then he's like, no, because December's almost over. I at least have a little bit left in me, like, I'm November.
I see.
Yeah,
which would be clunky in dialogue, but
technically the studio announced that there is a sequel coming, so maybe they'll just turn it into a rom-com, because that'll make more money.
December Man.
Yeah.
Man,
romance.
You were one bleak motherfucker. I just love, like, that that line. But yeah, bad film.
Or Roger Donaldson.
Yeah, I haven't seen every Roger Donaldson film, but this is probably the worst film he's ever made.
Yeah, The Bank Job is good. His last one.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then I just want to shout out some love to The Leftovers, which ended while I was in Toronto. It's a HBO series, and it's really fantastic. It's like one of the most consistently good first seasons of television that I've ever seen. And it's well acted, well directed, very powerful, very emotional. I don't think you could binge watch this show. So yeah, The Leftovers. It's over, so I can't tell you to make sure to look out for it Sunday nights, but it is on HBO Go. I recommend you check it out. It is getting a second season, and it is it's 100% worth it. So that's that. Any final thoughts before we get into our feature review of A Walk Among the Tombstones?
I guess it's good that it's fall. Some more promising movies coming.
Yeah. I was thinking about it. I'm like, we haven't done this in a while, and then I was like, what would we even have talked about?
Yeah.
Nothing. So we're coming back with, as Danny said, kind of a minor-ish film, but you know, an adult, you know, single shot, you know, I don't even know how to describe it. It's the type of movie that I feel like they used to make a lot more of.
Like, definitely.
Just a movie that didn't have pretensions towards a franchise or anything. And yet here we are, where this is like the weirdest thing. It's like I said about Prisoners last year. It's like, isn't it cool just have like a movie?
Yeah,
like, Prisoners was sick.
Yeah, it's just like, isn't it great just to have like a crime drama that's like low key, you know, anchored by some interesting performances and, you know, good direction, and, you know, it's here and it's gone, and maybe I'll check it out again. But like, you know, it's just, it's not, it doesn't happen anymore. It's fucking bullshit. But A Walk Among the Tombstones, the newest film by writer-director Scott Frank, who hasn't been in the director's chair since 2007's The Lookout, which starred Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And he comes back here adapting a book by Lawrence Block starring Liam Neeson. And not really anyone else that you'd recognize. But when you got Liam Neeson, what else do you need?
Dan Stevens. He's getting a little more popular.
Is he?
Well, Downton Abbey, I guess he's in, which I've never seen, and then The Guest, so I guess not really. But.
Okay, well, he's in some stuff, but anyway, here is the trailer.
So you're a private detective.
Unlicensed. I do favors for people. In return, they give me gifts. So, what can I do for you?
Someone's kidnapped my wife. Them, but they killed her anyway. I want you to find the men who did this and bring them to me.
So in this film, Liam Neeson is a former cop, current private investigator, unlicensed, Matthew Scudder, which is a name that is not as annoying as you would think, oddly enough. And he has been asked to help a man find the people who kidnapped his wife. The twist here being, and I say twist, the twist on the story, not the twist that, like, oh my god, M. Night Shyamalan directed this. The twist is that he has already paid the money for his wife's safe return, but she was returned not safe at all. So Liam Neeson sets out to find the people who did this and bring them to justice or help a man deliver his unholy revenge. So guys, A Walk Among the Tombstones. What did we think? Spoiler-free to begin. We will hop into a spoiler section later. Jordan Rout, you're the guest. Why don't you help us out? What did you think of A Walk Among the Tombstones?
Sure, yeah. I was a big fan of a Walk Among the Tombstones. I feel like you have to say it like that. No, it was great. Not great. Very good, I thought. I really liked just how Scott Frank kind of puts you in this world, which is, I thought some stuff didn't quite work, like the Y2K stuff, because this takes place in 1999. Mostly, there's one scene at the beginning, which is 8 years prior. But I really liked kind of, I would say, like the setting and just the way the editing, I think, is top notch here, where it's not just, you know, A to B, clean cut, like kind of just going through the rhythms. I think there's some really inventive stuff they do to make it much more succinct in terms of catching you up with everything going on. There's a lot of overlaying of, you know, he's in Alcoholics Anonymous, so there's some of that peppered in, and we can talk about later how it's peppered in even more. But I think that really works, kind of setting up the character. He doesn't really have much of a backstory aside from a flashback at the beginning. And I like that. You know, he's just kind of a lone wolf kind of walking through the streets of Brooklyn, the CD streets. And yeah, and I really like the character work, and a lot of the exchanges kind of subvert kind of the normal cliches, whether it's, you know, a talk about a gun, the usage of guns, or kind of downplaying what could have been a, you know, a taken encounter where he goes on a rampage. So the kind of that kind of stuff really, really works well. And you know, like Brian said, it's a movie that you kind of feel doesn't get made anymore. Like a mid-budget R-rated adult drama that is fairly intelligent for what it is. And yeah, so I quite enjoyed it.
All right, Danny King, what about yourself?
Yeah. I also really enjoyed this film. Like I said, I was looking forward to it a lot, and it started off very strong. And then during the opening credits, there was a moment, because Jordan and I saw this together, where it said cinematography by Mihai Malamer Jr., who shot The Master. And we both kind of looked at each other like,
oh,
man.
We both audibly gasped.
Yeah. Because I was like,
the only people
so
ever to gasp at a cinematographer credit.
Yeah. It was like, because I was already excited, and then just to see that, it was like, oh my God, this is like the best film I ever made. But yeah, I think the movie especially starts off really strong. You mentioned Dan Stevens, who plays the guy who hires Liam Neeson, and their first scene together in his like palace, he's very rich drug trafficker, was really impressive, because Stevens himself is like extremely creepy. And there's ultimately like not that much to his character, but just as a way to like introduce some menace into the atmosphere, I thought that scene was really good. And there's like a portrait on the wall of his wife that's very creepy. And there's a really good line where he asks Neeson about his time on the force, and he asks him like if he took bribes, and Neeson's like, yeah, you know, I wouldn't have been able to support my family without it, or
yeah,
something.
Like, why'd you leave the force? Was it corruption? He's like, yeah. No, I didn't mind that. It would have been hard to support my family without
it. such a great line.
Yeah. And the movie's peppered with lines like that. It's just fantastic.
Yeah. So just stuff like that, like, really sucked me in right away. And there's a lot of like locations that seem underused compared to other New York crime movies, like the cemetery seemed pretty unique and unusual. Even the library where he first meets this kid who kind of becomes his sidekick was interesting. And there's like a nice shot where he's like looking through the microfilm, and the reflection of it is kind of like on his face. That was pretty cool. I think the movie, towards the end, there were some things I had issues with that we can talk about in spoilers. But overall, I'm definitely a fan. And just to echo what you guys said, and what we probably said when we talked about Prisoners or anything like this, is that it would be good to have more of these movies. And even though Brian said this isn't something that would like span a sequel, it is a character I wouldn't mind seeing again, especially because it's based on a series.
Yeah, but it's not like someone walks up to him and is like, hey, you know, I got a, that was easy. Like, I've got a whole new one for you.
Yeah, there's not like a stupid ending scene like that.
Yeah.
It's definitely a standalone.
Like, I could see this guy doing another film. Like, almost like how Indiana Jones used to do. Like, yeah, love the fact that we got some more Indiana Jones movies. But at the end of each Indiana Jones movie, someone didn't walk up and, you know.
Yeah.
Or there wasn't like a scene at the end where it's like a guy gets a phone call and it's like, hey, this is so-and-so, and this guy, he like destroyed our plans. His name is Indiana Jones. It's like, well, we'll see about him. Dun, dun, dun.
Directed by Scott Frank.
So yeah, I actually really love this movie. I just got a new edict that I'm just going to throw out there. If a movie begins with Liam Neeson drinking too much, chances are it's going to be great.
Nonstop.
I mean, this movie now, it's just like, it's like there's a producer out there somewhere who's like, if you give me Liam Neeson and a drinking problem, I'll gift you a big hit. I don't know why he talks like a 1930s radio announcer, but obviously that's just what he does. But yeah, I like this movie. Even the opening scene wherein he lays witness to a holdup at a bar was really great. And just the way it's shot and the way that the scenes are laid out, the way everything is kind of blocked. I mean, it's just, it's good. It's not show-offy. It all serves
well, the one
story.
Thing I was going to say specifically about that was the moment I knew I was going to like it was literally, I feel like Scott Frank was like, all right, guys, we need the plainest text possible for our title sequence, like the title card, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then the one locked off shot where he's just walking down the steps and it's like a walk among the tombstones.
Yeah.
And from that moment, I was like, oh yeah, this is going to be good.
This is good. This is a good thing that I'm watching right now.
Sorry.
Yeah. It's not like a CGI, like showing like a gun or like, you know, people's names being written in whiskey as it's poured. No, it's just like, you could do it on iMovie. It's just text overlaid on the screen. And I say you can do it on iMovie. That's not a knock, because simplicity fits this movie. Because in the end, it is a very simple story. It's a very simple look at this man's life and what he does. But the twists and the turns of the narrative are great. I'm a huge fan of detective thrillers, and I like how this one sort of serves as a deconstruction while at the same time still playing into some tropes. And it's not a deconstruction insofar as, like, the killer has read, you know, these books on detective work or something like that. Like, this kid, TJ, who could very easily have been a damn annoying character, like Shia LaBeouf in iRobot or Shia LaBeouf in Constantine or Shia LaBeouf in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. sorry, Shia, just pick fucking better movies. This kid is great. Like, he, when they begin his whole little introduction, I was like, I don't know how I feel about this. But then it took all of like 2 minutes for me to completely be like, yeah, I would watch like 12 films. with
his name
these
is Brian. Brian Bradley.
It was great. I loved it. It was fantastic. And you know, it's like, yeah, it's probably, it might not make my top 10 of the year list. It probably won't. But it's the type of film where it's like, I could see this again. I would tell people to go see it. It's just, yeah, it's like, it feels weird because it's like, oh, well, you know, it's not like, I can't say like the person made it for $500,000, so you got to see it. And it's not like a $200 million spectacle, so you got to see it. It's just a good movie.
That's what we're saying. I mean, it's the kind of movie that, like Prisoners, was probably 20 to 40 million.
But it's almost like I don't even know how to talk about those kind of movies anymore.
Which is sad. That's depressing.
I know. It's a fucking
not because of you. Because they're not making. But yeah, no, it's almost great just because of how competent it is and what it does, which is rare, which is sad.
Yeah, and I mean, there are points in this movie where I can kind of tell what's going to happen in the scene, but the way the scene is constructed and the way it's acted and the way that the thing I knew was going to happen happens, it works fantastically well. And it was good. I liked it. I liked it a lot. I definitely recommend that people should go out and see this. I don't know, have they given like estimates as to how well it's doing?
Yeah, it did okay, not great. It's not like a take and breakout, but another thing we should note is that this movie is nothing like, you know, Nonstop or Taken.
Yeah, no. And that's the other great thing
is
is like that, you know, kind of like The Gray was. It's like, oh, it's Liam Neeson and he's going to do some crazy shit. But no, it's like a mournful kind of look at like the real reality of what happens when terrible things happen to terrible people. Or even just tortured people. I mean, it's great. It is apparently second place for the weekend, with an estimated $13 million. So that's good. That's respectable. That's what I'd expect from this, I guess.
Yeah.
And it doesn't overstay its welcome, and it's also not too short. It's just it's just a great balanced, well made movie. and it's just good to see Scott Frank again.
Yeah, The Lookout was really solid.
I loved The Lookout. I'm still pissed off at the friend of mine who hasn't given me my goddamn DVD back, because that guy's a jerk. But I mean, he made that, and it was like a really well-done, well-written, well-directed film, and then he just kind of went away for a while. He still has been working as a writer. He actually wrote The Wolverine, along with some.
That's been kind of a little misreported, I think. I think he
did not write the Wolverine.
He did, but it was he wrote some of that. He like did a rewrite on it, so I don't think it was
because it was initially Mark Bombach.
Yeah, someone did something.
Right, Scott Frank did someone wrote the Wolverine. We're sure of that. It's not the Avengers. We know that someone wrote the Wolverine. On the Avengers. But yeah, no.
Marley and me, which is really strange. Wow,
that is bizarre.
Oh, of course, yeah. He wrote Out of Sight and Minority Report, which you guys have obviously seen. And if you haven't, it kind of reminded me of Out of Sight in some ways. This movie,
yeah,
it's not as funny, but
Get Shorty.
Yeah,
I mean, he did some good stuff. An episode of The Wonder Years. Anyway, yeah, really, really great movie. I cannot think of a single bad thing to say about it.
Oh, there's some.
Well,
bad
maybe we'll get into that in spoilers. But it's just like, you know, even in a good movie, like that everyone loves, I can usually find something bad to say. But I guess it's just this movie, its ambitions were so grounded and it pulled them off so ably that it's like, I won't be made to dwell on it long enough to find something wrong with it. Which again, I mean, is a compliment. Yeah. Any final thoughts before we get into spoilers?
No, go see it. Yeah. If you're looking for something to transition from the kind of craziness spectacle of the summer versus and then going into something with more meat on the bones, this is kind of the perfect transition because there's a little action, but and it's not you know the most mind-blowing movie ever, but it's very well done.
Yeah, it's the perfect bridge between the summer action film and then the prestige picks we're gonna start getting.
Yep.
All right, so let's talk about spoilers for A Walk Among the Tombstones. So, Danny, you said you had some issues with the ending.
Yeah. One thing I'll also mention really quick was that after seeing the film, I'm sort of annoyed I got the trailer so many times because the trailer is a little bit deceptive. There's a scene, one of the like most interesting scenes in the movie is Neeson's interaction with this cemetery groundskeeper. And then they go up to the roof of his apartment building, and the scene ends with him jumping off the building.
Yeah, and that's one of the scenes I was talking about where it's like, this guy's going to jump off the building.
Yeah.
But then the way the camera moved and the way that he did it, it was interesting. It was good.
Mm-hmm. And that's in the trailer, but the way it's like presented in the trailer, it makes it look like the movie has like a supernatural dimension.
What?
Which, yeah, like
I agree. Yeah, the guy seemed like he's been like taken over by a spirit or something.
Yeah, like he's like it seems like he's not jumping to his death. It seems like he like can fly.
I have not seen whatever trailer it is you're talking about.
So yeah,
it's literally the shot, but just the way it's cut is like Liam Neeson's talking to him, and then it's just
so weird.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that the trailer like starts with like the detail of his backstory.
The fact that he killed the little girl.
Yeah, which is kind of annoying. I mean, it's not like... I mean, I guess it's a pretty important reveal.
Yeah,
so it's annoying.
It's funny, though, because when I saw that scene, like, he's chasing this guy and just firing.
Yeah, it's
and
like
I was
brutal.
Like, you know, for... I was like, this is something that always bothers me, because, like, when a movie has pretensions towards realism, and then it has, like, a running shootout in a busy city street, I'm just like, come on, like, that's not a good idea. And so when it's revealed that that's what happened, I was like, oh, right, great. The movie knew to address that. And then I was like, ooh, shit, a little girl is dead.
Yeah, it's pretty like striking how that opening scene plays, like how quickly he starts firing.
Yeah.
It's clearly like a drunk mess.
I love that line when he's like, I wasn't brave, I was just drunk.
Yeah. And then, yeah, that leads into like the main thing I wasn't sure about was the use of like the 12 steps during the climax.
Oh, I love that.
That felt really, really awkward to me.
Really?
Yeah. It's no sort of, yeah, I mean, you can express your differing view, but for some reason it's like, I like the 12 steps idea as like, an aspect of his character that felt really organic. Like they never really make a big deal out of any of the AA scenes in the movie. They're just sort of there. And you get the sense that it's like a routine. But then by the climax, when it's like saying out the 12 steps out loud, it almost I feel like it foregrounds the alcoholism too much, where like I feel like I should be more worried about the confrontation and like the people.
For me, it's almost like, yeah, the alcoholism was a problem, but when they're talking about the 12 steps then, it really seems to attach itself directly to the situation he's in. Not just in a way of his drinking, but in a way of how he's handling this situation.
Yeah.
So I like that because like they show him at the AA meetings, and one of the biggest things about the AA meeting is you're supposed to come clean about everything.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He consistently leaves out the fact that his actions resulted in a little girl getting shot.
Mm-hmm.
Like every time.
That's true. Can't deny that.
Yeah.
And that's so on the screen.
That whole thing where it's, you know, going through the steps and showing what's happening, especially that heartbreaking moment when the person's like, you know, come clean of like all the wrongs that you've done, unless those wrongs will like harm someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the brother is dying and is going to tell his brother, you know, that he was in love with his wife, but then he dies first.
Oh yeah.
And then the guy's like, I love you too, man. It was just like, that was harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, I kind of see both ways. I think the simplicity of the movie kind of, it tries to go to another level when it adds that in. And so for me, it's like trying to do something that I feel like it didn't necessarily was fully successful in. Like, I like the idea. The execution, I thought, was just a little.
The one thing I can agree with that is that they take a break between like step.
Yeah. So I was wondering if they were going to stop at some point, like assume that.
Yeah, you know the other.
He's thinking about all 12, or I don't know.
But like when he decides, so they catch the criminals, these two complete and utter psychopaths, who. At first I thought this is one of the fun aspects of this film is like it's not like it's someone that you've met, like you know that these two random guys are two random guys and you're just trying to find them, which is something that I like in movies, because like Prisoners did a decent job of getting past this, but there's like the old saw that like if you just look at whoever is the person who you recognize the most.
Right.
And whoever has like the smallest part, or like,
why you kind of the movie wants you to think it's Dan Stevens in a way, you know, just because he has
really.
I would say something.
The movie. I don't think the movie ever made me want to think it was Dan Stevens was the drug trafficker, right?
But
yeah,
there was not a single moment where you're like, oh, maybe he's someone in this in a way. I don't know.
Do you think you're positing that the movie wanted you to believe that he was responsible for his wife's death?
Not responsible, but just might have. Well, yeah, potentially. Like he might have been involved in some way and deeper. Maybe a lesser movie would have done that. Whereas this.
Oh yeah, this one did not do that at all, which is great.
I guess just because he's so creepy, you know.
So
good
creepy.
Job, Dan.
I didn't find him to be creepy.
It's not like over the top. It's just like he has the like weird eyes.
He is a very like. I guess I don't think creepy. Maybe like disconcerting presence.
Yeah, like I think it's a really good performance, but I. I think I know what Jordan's saying. It just kind of like he just kind of keeps you on your toes, like when you're watching him.
But I love the fact that, you know, there's a thing that happens in a lot of movies where it's like, like my wife is missing, or you know, blah blah blah, and it's just very much like a written thing. It's like, yeah, this woman doesn't need to have an identity. It's just this guy's wife, and she's the reason that this is happening. And then he shows up at Liam Neeson's apartment.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, you know, I realize that I didn't say her name. You know, it's like, because I can't. And he, like, really goes into the full story. And it's kind of like his vulnerability and breaking down a bit. And, you know, it was things like that that, like, really pulled it out of the usual tropes that a movie like this traffics in.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, the killers, I thought... I mean, they did a great job of just being creepy, but I just
were creepy as shit.
I think. What did you think of like the way? Because the first half of the movie, he tries to at least shoot it in a way where it's kind of mysterious. But then by the second half, there's scenes where they're just talking. Literally, you see their life together, and in one scene where they're like eating breakfast, which I don't know. I liked. I either wish he kind of made them more mysterious throughout the movie, or maybe had it where we spent more time with them. I don't know. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I think maybe the scene where they're having breakfast was the one that felt the most off. But I think once they start interacting with Liam on the phone, that stuff's really funny and strong. The only thing that's weird about the breakfast part is that the movie initially does a pretty good job of like taking the violence seriously and, you know, like Brian said, not just using it as like window dressing or something like that. But the humor in the breakfast scene is just a little bit uncomfortable to like make like these psychos kind of like funny. I don't know. It sort of turned me off a little bit, but
I was again disconcerted, but I don't know that I was whatever that other word is that we're using.
Wasn't a deal breaker for you.
Not a deal breaker.
Yeah, right? No. Oh yeah, Jordan, did you want to talk about like the Soderbergh thing?
Oh yeah. So it's supposedly kind of interesting. Supposedly Steven Soderbergh had like a kind of a decent hand in the editing, or at least not, you know, maybe not physically, but just with notes. Because he releases like this film log of everything he's watched, and like a few months ago he watched like A Walk Among the Tombstones like 8 or 9 times in like 2 weeks. And so we were like, oh, interesting. And yeah, and so finally, like when the press tour came around for this movie, Scott Frank explained that like it was actually the way they edited it was a much more conventional crime thriller. And I guess that wasn't the way he initially conceived of it. So Steven Soderbergh was kind of the one that saw the movie and was like, hey, man, you should really make you should really edit the way that you originally wanted. And see, you know, what happens. And so thank you, Steven Soderbergh. And I guess, I don't know if that directly resulted in it, but there was a whole supporting character that got cut. Ruth Wilson played she played his partner. I don't know if it was in the flashbacks or if it was, I assume because if she was his partner, it would have been when he was actually a cop. So, but yeah, so, I mean, she's a pretty big up-and-coming actress, so I was surprised that that they cut that all out. But yeah, and so I guess they wanted to just make Liam Neeson the sole kind of presence and have no attachments.
Yeah, really turn into like an examination of him and not just the plot.
Yeah, so there's a very, very, very different movie lying somewhere on the editing floor, which is kind of interesting. But I'm glad they obviously went with the one they did because I really like the way it was cut.
It's like, what was that movie, Keen?
Oh.
When they released it on DVD, they had the Steven Soderbergh cut.
Yeah.
Any other issues with this movie at the end that we want to talk about?
No, I liked a lot. I mean, the stuff in the basement kind of turns it into a little bit of, I mean, I think the movie kind of does get a little bit more generic as it goes along. Like it loses that, I will say, cause I didn't really touch on this a lot, but like the scene I think is one of the best scenes of the movie is where the third, like suspect or the third guy in this ring who eventually jumps off the building where he discovers Neeson and you're like, oh man, this is going to be an epic fight. And Liam Neeson just through a couple sentences, like talks him down from,
it's like, you know, I can't let you out of here. You're going to stab me with that big fucking knife.
Exactly. And then that scene I think is great. And then like the scene with him and, Brian Bradley's character, the kid, when the kid has the gun and Liam Neeson like explains then all the mechanics of a gun and then is like, that's exactly why you shouldn't have one.
Yeah.
And then I think by the last act it kind of loses some of that inventiveness just in the scripting when it becomes kind of just more, you know, from the 12 steps on, I think it becomes just kind of a more generic movie, which isn't, I mean, I don't know another way to wrap this up, but I think it could have been, you know, done a little bit with more creativity. I don't know. That's my thought.
Okay. I don't know. So, I didn't really have any issues with
that. Yeah. So I said a very, very good first two thirds and a good last third.
Yeah. I will say that like they already had one kid in trouble narrative and I was really nervous that they were going to do another one.
Mm.
When TJ is in the back of and so I was glad when like his phone rings and it's like, oh no, but then it's immediately like, yeah, no, he's fine.
Yeah. Oh, I will touch out a great use of, I think, Donovan's Atlantis when the next victim is crossing the street. And so I don't know if that was like a Zodiac shout out because they use Donovan a lot in that, but but it was definitely, you know, again, the creepy factor. Good job, Scott Frank.
That did pull me back to Zodiac, because I was like, what is that other movie that used Donovan to really unnerving effect?
Yeah, they used that a lot.
Oh yeah, it was Hurdy Gurdy Man.
Yeah.
In Zodiac. All right. Well, yeah, I think that's all. Walk Among the Tombstones out in wide release now. Go check it out. Then, yep. Were you going to say something?
I agree. Go check it out, everyone.
Sweet. Then let's talk about what's coming out to DVD and Blu-ray. Couple things. We've got bad. What? Wait a second.
Just Neighbors. Bad Neighbors.
I was about to say, why is Bad Neighbors on the cover of this DVD?
That was the UK. UK, they call it Bad Neighbors.
What is that movie? Edge of Tomorrow? Where, like, they've retitled it for the DVD release?
I guess in the UK, like, there's Good Neighbors. So in the US, they just everyone knows all Neighbors are just not.
Everybody
not
knows
good.
Neighbors fucking are bullshit.
Exactly. So very important neighbors. Distinction.
Anyway, I saw that on the DVD cover. I was like, that's not right. So Neighbors, the Seth Rogen, Zac Efron film, as well as Rose Byrne. Sadly, I still haven't seen that, but I am looking forward
to it.
Oh,
that's fine. It was, I mean, crazy successful at the box office, but I just personally, I thought it was just fine. Not one of Seth Rogen's best movies, but I think it's only like 90 minutes, so just watch it.
Jesus, there's such like acquiescence in that. Just watch it.
Craig Roberts' Star of Submarine is in it for like literally 3 seconds, so no, a little bit longer than that, but he's good.
As long as he was in the double?
He was for very briefly too.
Yeah, no. I'm trying to, which one has more Craig Roberts?
I guess Neighbors, but it's funny, he was also in 22 Jump Street for like 3 seconds, so I guess that's his claim to fame this summer. He was in the two most successful comedies for
for three seconds.
A combined 3 minutes.
Man. Blu-ray issues on Criterion, The Innocents, and Macbeth. The Rover is also coming out. You'll recall that we talked about that and we quite enjoyed it. Danny, did you like it?
I was mixed on the Rover.
Okay, well, I thought it was great, so listen to me.
I was mixed on the Rover.
And then we have The Signal, which I never saw, but
I saw that. It's weird. That movie could have actually kind of been like a sleeper hit this summer, but I don't know what happened with it, because it's not a great movie, but it's a pretty well done, like, sci-fi kind of twisty kind of, as the box cover art says, a mind bending experience. I want to go that far, but it is kind of an interesting little movie that kind of no one saw at all, which I was surprised by. But
yeah, because I kept hearing like it was going to festivals, and I figured that someone would snatch it up and try to make a big thing about it. But
yeah,
apparently not.
If you like The Matrix and Dark City, it's like 1/10 as good as those, but it's still kind of
well. The Matrix was only like 1/5 as good as Dark City. So if it's 1/10 as good as both of those, then maybe it's what percentage is that now?
I don't know. This is not a math podcast. But.
No, that's exactly why it is a movie podcast. we also have Ida coming out. Do you want to do that now?
Yeah. So we have we're giving away 5 total Blu-rays on the site. So. It's just a free for all on this movie, so you can just come get one. Probably the chances are we'll go back to our math podcast, and the chances are strong that you could win one if you're listening to now, because we're going to give away 2 of them on just for our Film Stage show listeners.
Yeah.
So all you have to do, ready? Pay attention. All you have to do is any tweet about the show that I usually tweet a few times out throughout the week about this specific episode. So if you see a tweet come up at Film Stage Show, all you have to do is make sure you're following us and retweet that, and I'll look and I'll select 2 of you guys. US only, sorry, everyone else.
Yeah, go fuck yourself, the rest of the world.
I know, especially Poland. Sorry.
Where this movie is from. Oh man.
I had a really amazing interview with the director this last week, and it's going to go up on the site.
Excellent.
And it's and he gives us an exclusive on his next project. It's not Transformers 5, so something
really
else.
Really hoping it would be.
I know, but better than that, he talks about the movie, which is really good. And so.
Oh, I thought you meant he talks about Transformers.
No. He does talk to us. He does talk about his favorite movies though of the year. So.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Any of the other things coming out? worthy of discussion? We got a couple of Blu-ray reissues, but I mean, like, it's The Exorcist and all the
Saw
other Exorcists.
And Halloween. I think they're just getting Halloween. Literally, the Halloween, the event, I guess. What is it? Holiday, I guess.
It's a holiday.
Yeah. Okay. I never know because it's kind of not like Christmas or Easter. It's just like
it's Halloween.
Anyways,
what are you,
it's Halloween.
What are you talking about? It's a holiday.
All right, but it's not like is it a national holiday?
Yeah, everyone knows that Halloween.
No, I know, but it
doesn't have like a religious context, and no one gets to miss work for it. Actually,
but that's what I mean. It's not like a recognized.
So I started a new job in like April, and everyone keeps saying that, like, you know, on Halloween, we basically shut down the office after like 2 hours of work, and then just have a massive party, and there's like costume contests and everything, like. How some companies treat Christmas, we treat Halloween, apparently.
And that's something to be proud of.
I'm like, that's how you know that this is a like startup education technology firm. Because it's like, yeah, we don't really think about, you know, families and Christmas. We think about getting blitzed and wearing costumes on Halloween. It's like, all right, that works for me.
I would say that because there is these three box sets, so I guess I would... And Saw, The Exorcist, or Halloween, so I would definitely go The Exorcist in terms of the scary factor. The first Halloween is great, though. I have actually not seen any other Halloweens. So, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, so coming to theaters, we have The Equalizer, the newest film from director Anton Fuqua, starring Denzel Washington and Chloe Grace Moretz. And this premiered at Toronto. Oddly enough, I didn't see it. I didn't really hear much about it. Was there any buzz? Like, is it goodish?
It won the festival. It just
it won every
the
award.
People's Choice Award. Yeah. It also won the critics' pick. And
best Canadian director. Everything. No, I'm just kidding. I've read some, you know, really horrible reviews, and then I've read people that are like, oh, it's a really fun throwback. Action movie. And I don't know. I mean, Antoine Fuqua, I thought he made the best White House Down-esque movie of last year. So with
the
Olympus
best White House Down-esque film known as Olympus Has Fallen.
Yes. So I did think that was the better of the two. But
thank God someone agrees with me.
But
the Jamie Foxx film. That's what I say.
I guess like his last movie, this one is also filled with like buckets of blood when someone gets shot. So if you're looking for that, this will do it. But it was
that's
odd.
Exactly
one, this movie was one time going to be directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, which was
man.
Yeah. Yep, he was attached to it for quite some time, and then he had creative differences. So
sucks.
So now we get a crappy Antoine Fuqua movie.
I saw the trailer for this for the first time today. And I guess it looks fine.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Maybe we'll talk about that next week. Otherwise, we're going to be talking about The Box Trolls.
Yeah. You can read my full review published like 4 weeks ago.
I remember you tweeting about this like a while ago.
Yeah, they screened it insanely early, like 2 months ago, I think I saw it. Early August. So.
And you had a fairly positive opinion, if I remember.
Yeah, it's good. It's I'll give like a one sentence thing. I think the story is kind of repetitive and basic, but the execution is really well done. So
excellent. Well, that's from our friends over at Leica, who made Paranorman and Coraline.
And I also have two extensive interviews with the CEO of that company and the directors going up this week, so read them. Yeah.
Coming out in limited release, we have Pride, which also screened at Toronto, but I did not see. The Two Faces of January, which I'll be damned if I've heard of before today.
Really?
Yeah.
It's speaking of Refn, it's the writer of Drive, Hossein Amini, his directorial debut, and it has a great cast. I haven't seen it, but Viggo Mortensen, Oscar Isaac, and Kirsten Dunst. And
I'm looking at this now. Did you know that he apparently had a hand in the screenplay for Snow White and the Huntsman?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes.
That's bizarre.
I chose to not mention that.
Well, I kind of enjoyed that movie.
Let's just say I'll side with Nick on the podcast.
That's fine. I'm down with that.
No, but I mean, it's kind of strange. This movie, it is getting like a really low profile release, so it makes me think that it's not really a great success. But who knows?
Yeah, especially
it premiered at Berlin
it's got
last Yeah.
It's got Aragorn. It's got Spider-Man's girlfriend for the first time. And it's got a guy who's going to be in a Star Wars film.
Yeah.
You would think that that would give it a boost, but I guess not.
Everything you just related to them, they've done better work in a million other movies, Brian. So come on.
I'm picking the most popular ones.
Okay. I see.
Like, I
see.
Could say the like the dad from A History of Violence.
There we go.
The crazy chick from Melancholia. And what has Oscar Isaac been good in?
He was going to Drive. And Inside
Llewyn. No, he was in Drive.
And Inside Llewyn Davis, his best performance.
Good performance in a just kind of okay movie.
Oh, stop.
I was going to say, I loved him as Blue in Sucker Punch.
Let's wrap things up.
The most Sucker Punch has been mentioned in any podcast since Sucker Punch came out.
Exactly.
Okay, we've also got Advanced Style, Lilting.
Which is supposed to be pretty good. Ben Whishaw.
Yeah, I'm undecided on Ben Whishaw.
Okay.
Fucking Cloud Atlas. Believe me, the song Days and Night, good lord, and The Little Bedroom.
Yeah. Supposedly, yeah. That's even, there's tons more coming out. So
God damn. All right. Well, that's a glut of films. I'm definitely excited for The Box Trolls, and I guess I could go and see The Equalizer with some friends, maybe. I don't know. None of these particularly interest me. Anyone's you guys that you're particularly excited about?
Equalizer, Denzel.
Okay. I mean, after Flight, I'll follow that man to the end.
Yeah, I'll see anything.
I hope to God he has a drinking problem in that.
In Equalizer?
I hope he has a drinking problem in Flight, because that was ambiguous.
Flight is great film.
The best movie.
The best movie of the week will definitely be Gone Girl, which I'm seeing Friday, so look back for our review.
Wait, but that's not coming out this week.
I know. I'm just teasing.
Yeah, I was about to say, don't be an asshole to the people who listen to this who can't see press.
They're excited.
Screens.
They want to see a review. So check back on the film stage.
I saw my first trailer for Gone Girl today, too. I've been doing a terrible job with keeping up with trailer releases, apparently.
I have actually started. I am not going to watch any more trailers. I have decided.
How will you go to the movie theater?
I usually see like press screens, but they don't have them.
Yeah,
so.
Well, la-di-da.
I know. It's easier. But online, I have to write about them and post about them. So I usually, it depends, I guess, what the movie is. So I didn't watch the last Interstellar one, and I didn't watch Big Eyes.
Wait, was
that a new one? The one that came out like with Guardians of the Galaxy. I haven't seen.
I don't think I saw that one.
Yeah, so good. Don't do it.
I guess I'll
and Inherent Vice, I'm going to stay strong if that ever comes out.
Which one?
The trailer for Inherent Vice, if it ever comes out.
Okay. All right, well, yeah, that's it. We're not going to do recently watched because that's what we did at the beginning of the show. So we're over. It's done. Let's just tell the people where we can be found. Obviously, you can find the Film Stage Show at Film Stage Show on Twitter. Be sure to follow us and retweet any tweet about this episode as a means of putting yourself in the running for a copy of Ida. And Danny King, where can we find you on the internet?
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And Jordan Raup.
And you can find me tweeting at JP Raup or at TheFilmStage on Twitter or at TheFilmStage.com.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can also find my work at TheFilmStage, TheFilmStage.com.
And Brian's great reviews.
Numerous reviews from TIFF. Yes. I didn't review three movies.
Oh my gosh. Brian,
I don't know. I didn't know what to say about them. One of them was so-so. The other one was good, but I couldn't think of enough to say about it. And the other one was also good, but it was just kind of like, cool.
Like, I couldn't, we'll have a chat about this later.
Oh God. This is gonna lose my job. I also have a personal site, brianjrowan.com. I don't really have shit on it though. But if you're specifically looking for links to things that I've written at the Film Stage, I put some up there. So that's that. I'll probably never mention that website again. But that's all. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. And come back next week and we'll be talking about either The Equalizer, a bloody R-rated action film, or The Box Trolls, a whimsical children's tale.